I watched Zaras bringing his men towards me as fast as the camels could gallop. These were all magnificent beasts. Over a short distance, the Bedouin horses would be able to outrun my camels, but they could not maintain that pace for more than 2 or 3 hours. On the other hand, my camels could run all day long, over sandy and treacherous ground. My camels had recently drunk their fill of water. They would not have to drink again for 10 or more days. In these conditions of thirst, heat, and heavy going in the sand, the horses would be down by sunrise tomorrow, while my camels could still be running a week from today. I had my orders for Zaras ready when he came up to where I stood. He had an armed man on the back of every camel. Very swiftly, I had half of them dismounted and on their way back to the cavern on foot to stand guard over the other 2 girls. Of course, Becatha's safety outweighed that of Loxias 100-fold, but nonetheless, I had grown fond of the little Cretan lass. Zaras had shown the good sense to have each of the camels loaded with full water skins. This accounted for his delayed arrival. Now half the saddles were empty, and I would be able to rotate the riders at regular intervals. I was also pleased to see that Zaras had brought our head guide, Al-Namju, with him. Nobody knew the ground better than he did. As we mounted up, with each rider leading a spare camel on a guide rope behind him, and the water skins bulging and gurgling reassuringly, I was prepared to wager a bag of silver mem that I would catch up with Al-Hawsawi before noon on the morrow. The wind had dropped to a soft breeze, but it was still too hot to give us much relief. At the very least, it no longer had the strength to obliterate the jackal's spoor until I had the chance to read it. I kept the camels moving at a pace that I judged carefully. I calculated the passage of time by the angle of the sun, and 3 hours later I could already see that we had gained substantially on our quarry. We stopped briefly to rotate our mounts, and I allowed the men to each drink 2 mugs of water before we started off again. We were not pushing hard yet, but keeping to a swinging trot that the camels made look so relaxed and easy. Another 2 hours, and I received proof positive that we were wearing down the fugitives. We came upon one of the jackal's horses, broken down and limping slowly along the tracks left by its herd mates. I was grimly satisfied with our progress, and I told Zaras that I hoped we might even catch them before nightfall. This opinion proved premature. An hour after I had expressed it, we came to the first split. I held up my hand to signal my cohort to halt. Then I confirmed this with a verbal command to Zaras. Let the men dismount and stretch their legs. They can each drink 2 mugs of water, but they must stay back and take care not to confuse the tracks until I have read them. Splitting the chase was an old Bedouin ploy that consisted of dividing their numbers into 2 equal groups. Then each group would take off in a separate direction. In this instance, it was doubly effective, in that it would be impossible for us to decide which of the 2 groups had taken Tahuti with them. We would be forced to split our own forces to follow both of theirs. I dismounted and handed the reins of my camel to Zaras to hold for me. I went forward on foot, stepping gingerly, until I reached the point at which the gang had split. I saw that they had not dismounted to do so. Thus I was unable to pick up Tahuti's footprints. I squatted down and once again called on my gods for help. Great Horus, let me see. Open these weak, blind eyes and show me the way, I beg you. Open my eyes, beloved Hathor, and I will make you a blood sacrifice to delight your heart. I closed my eyes and listened to my heart beat 20 times before I opened them again. I looked around carefully, but my eyesight was unaltered. The desert was the same. There was no translucent glow lighting the brutal sands, no dancing shadows to lead me on. Then I heard a voice, and I cocked my head to listen to it. But it was only the wind, soughing through the dunes. I turned my head slowly to allow the wind to brush my ear. I heard her then, softly but distinctly. Let Hathor, show you the way. It was the voice of Tehuti. I looked about me quickly, expecting to find her at my shoulder. But she was not there. I closed my eyes and waited for the little miracle I knew would come. Silently, I bowed my head and closed my eyes in atonement to the goddess Hathor for the recent derogatory thoughts I had directed at her. We need you now, sweet Hathor. Tehuti and I need you. Then a scene from years ago began to replay itself behind my closed eyelids. Tehuti and I were once again in the small reed boat, drifting on the sacred waters of the Nile. She was smiling with delight and holding up the gift which I had just given her to celebrate the red flowering of her womanhood. It was a lovely jewel into which I had worked all my love and all my skill. On a fine chain was suspended a tiny golden head of Hathor, the horned goddess of love and virginity. Still smiling, Tehuti passed the gold chain around her neck and with both hands secured the clasp behind her. The golden head dangled down into the valley of silken skin between her breasts, and the image of the goddess smiled at me enigmatically. "I shall wear it always, Tata." I recalled Tehuti's exact words. "Every time I feel it against my skin, I shall think of you, and my love for you will grow stronger." She had kept her promise. Whenever we were reunited after even a brief absence, she showed me the charm, dangling it on the gold chain and then touching it to her lips. Why I had thought of that now, when time and speed were so critical, I could not fathom, and I tried to put it out of my mind. The memory persisted. Then, with a sudden stab of excitement, it occurred to me that the jewel would by now be imbued with Tehuti's essential ethos. I would be able to detect it as unerringly as if she were here in the flesh. Then the voice in the wind confirmed what I had already sensed. "Find Hathor, and you will find me." When I jumped to my feet, I was still standing at the point at which Al-Hosawi's gang had split. I saw that one group of 10 had turned away towards the north. I decided to follow them first. I moved slowly, keeping to one side of the tracks made by the hooves of their horses. I opened my inner senses to receive directions from either Tehuti or from Hathor. I felt nothing. I kept walking, and then I felt an emotion stir within me. It was a sense of frustration and loneliness which grew stronger with every step I took. I turned back towards the point from which I had started, and the unpleasant sensation subsided gradually, and then evaporated when I reached the splitting point again. The second group of bandits had turned away towards the south. I followed their tracks. Almost immediately, I felt a lift of my spirits. I grew more elated with every few paces I took. And then I felt a small, warm hand take my own and squeeze it. I looked down, but my hand was empty, and I knew with complete certainty that there was a presence beside me, leading me on. I ran forward, searching the surface of the parched sands. I covered another 100 paces before I saw something sparkle on the desert floor ahead of me. It was half buried in the yellow sand, but I recognized it at once. I went down on one knee and brushed the loose sand aside. Then I picked up the tiny scrap of yellow gold, and I touched it to my lips. I looked back at Zaras. He was standing beside his camel, watching me. I waved one hand above my head, beckoning him. He mounted quickly and urged his camel forward, dragging my own animal behind him on his lead rein. "How can you be so certain that she went this way and not the other?" he demanded as he handed the reins of my camel to me. "Do you know this trinket?" I opened my hand and showed him the goddess's head cupped in my palm. He nodded, speechlessly. "She left it for me to find, as a sign." "She is so wonderful." His tone was reverent. "There can be no other woman to compare with her in all this world." We rode on for 2 hours before we came upon another of the Bedouin horses broken down. It stood with its head hanging, unable to take another step. Its rider had flogged it mercilessly before he abandoned it. Its hindquarters were lacerated by the whiplash, and the blood had congealed black and shiny on the wounds. "Give it water," I ordered, and Zaras himself dismounted to fill a leather bucket from the water-skin that his camel carried. At the same time, I also dismounted and took up a position behind the animal's shoulder. I drew my sword. Zaras placed the bucket of water in front of the unfortunate beast, and it dipped its muzzle into it. I allowed it to suck a few mouthfuls before I lifted my sword with both hands above my head. The animal was still drinking when I brought the blade down with all my weight and strength behind it. Decapitated cleanly, the head sprang from the stump of the neck. The carcass dropped to its knees, with blood pumping from the severed blood vessels. Then it toppled over sideways. "Don't waste the water," I warned Zaras, as I wiped my blade clean on the horse's shoulder, and then ran it back into its scabbard. I watched Zaras pour the remains of the water into the bucket, back into the water skin. I needed a few moments to regain my composure. I was suffering almost as much as the horse had done before my mercy stroke. I detest unnecessary cruelty and suffering in all its forms, and the horse had been savagely abused. However, I prevented my true feelings from showing. If they had known how I felt, my men would probably have thought me eccentric and lost a little of their respect for me. By the time the sun touched the horizon, we had passed another 3 downed horses, and I could see, by the increased bite of the tracks in the sand, that some of the fugitive Arabs were doubled up in the saddle, behind their companions. Others were reduced to walking, clinging on to the stirrup leathers of their companions to keep themselves on their feet. We gained more rapidly on them with every hour that passed. I kept my cohort moving after the sun had set. At last, the full moon came up to light our way. It was so silvery bright that it threw a shadow in each of the hoof marks that the Arab horses had imprinted in the sand. I could pick them out from afar. Hathor is the moon goddess, so I knew that this was her answer to my prayers. We moved forward at a pace that I judged was twice that of the chase. The camels responded willingly. We passed 2 more fallen horses beside the trail, but I saw that they were beyond suffering, and did not waste more time attending to them. Then I came upon a human figure lying directly in our path. There was something familiar about it. This time I halted my camel and forced it to kneel. "Take care, Taita," Zaras called to me anxiously. "This could be a trap. He may be playing dead. Perhaps he is holding a knife ready in his hand." I heeded his warning and drew my sword. But when I stood over the human form, it stirred, lifted its head painfully, and looked up at me. The moonlight played on the man's face, and I recognized him. I stared at him, so astonished at first, I was unable to speak. "What is it, Taita? What ails you?" Zaras shouted at me. "Do you know this man?" I did not reply directly to his queries. "Send Al-Namju to me," I ordered, without looking back at Zaras. The man at my feet was whimpering with terror as he stared up at me. Then he covered the lower half of his face with the tattered keffiyeh headdress that was knotted around his throat and turned his head away from me. I heard Zaras calling Al-Namju to come forward, and then the sound of his camel being forced to kneel behind me. "Come here to me, Al-Namju." My tone was harsh. I heard the crunching of his footsteps in the sand as he came to stand beside me. I did not look around at him.
"I am here, master," he answered softly.
"Do you recognize this person?" I touched the man lying at my feet with the toe of my sandal.
"No, lord. I cannot see his face,"
Al-Namju murmured softly. But by the tremor in his voice, I knew he was lying.
I reached down and grabbed the corner of the kefir headdress and ripped it off the man's face. I heard Al-Namju gasp. "You see his face now," I told him. "Who is he?" There was a drawn-out silence, and the supine figure buried his face in the crook of his arm, and he began to sob in broken gusts. He was unable to look up at us. "Tell me, Al-Namju, who is this piece of stinking pig shit?" The figure of speech I had chosen to describe him was evidence of my outrage and distress.
"He is my son, Harun," the old man whispered.
"And why is your son weeping, Al-Namju?"
"He is weeping because he has betrayed the trust you and I placed in him, Lord."
"How did he betray our trust, old man?"
"He told Al-Hasawi, the jackal, where he could find us. He led him to the cavern pool to lie in wait for us."
"What is the fitting punishment for such treachery, Al-Namju?"
"The punishment is death. You must kill Harun, Lord."
"No, old man," I drew my sword. "I will not kill him. He is your son. You must kill him."
"I cannot kill my own son, master."
He recoiled from me.
"It would be the darkest and vilest deed imaginable. My son and I would be doomed to the dark other world of Seth for all eternity."
"Kill him and I will pray for your soul. You know that I am a man of power. You know that I am an intercessor with the gods. It is always possible that they will hearken to my prayers. You will have to take your chances on that."
"Please, beloved master, spare me this terrible duty."
Now he was also weeping, but silently. I could see the tears sparkling on his beard, silver in the moonlight. He fell to his knees and kissed my feet. "To die by his father's hand is the only fitting punishment for him." I denied his entreaties. "Stand up, Al-Namju. Kill him, or I will kill your two younger sons, Talal and Musa, first. Then I will kill Harun. And finally I will kill you. There will be no male line in your house. There will be nobody to pray for your shade." He came to his feet shakily, and I placed the hilt of my sword in his hands. He stared into my eyes, and he saw that my determination was hard as any diamond. He dropped his eyes in resignation. "Do it," I insisted. And with both hands he wiped the tears from his own face. Then he raised his chin determinedly and grasped the hilt of the sword that I was offering him. He stepped past me and stood over Harun. "Do it," I repeated. And he lifted the sword and struck once, twice, and a third time. Then he dropped my sword and collapsed on top of the corpse of his eldest son. He hugged the cloven head to his chest, and the yellow brains oozed out between his fingers. He began the keening wail of mourning. I picked up my sword and wiped the blade on the corpse. Then I went back to my camel and mounted up. I left Al-Namju to come to terms with his loss, and I took up the trail of the jackal once more. My sense of compassion does not encompass all of mankind. My magnanimity does not cover all the sins committed against me.
In the first light of dawn we came to the spot at which Al-Hasawi had split his troop for the second time. This was an act of desperation. By now he must be certain that his first split had not thrown me off his tail. I dismounted and studied the tracks to make an estimate of the Bedouin numbers. There were 6 horses in one group and 4 in the second. Every horse was carrying 2 riders. That added up to 20 in total. In addition, there were 5 men walking. I raised my eyes to follow the spoor left by the larger troop, which had turned off towards the north, and my heart pounded as I saw the small and dainty footprints that I knew so well following them. They had taken Tahuti with them. However, she was now dismounted, and I saw from the signs that she was being dragged along unwillingly by 2 of the Arabs. I ran forward to examine her footprints more closely. My relief flared up in anger as I saw that one of her bare feet was bleeding. She had cut it on the jagged chips of flint which littered the sand. The trail was clear and unambiguous. I had not the slightest doubt that Tahuti was with the group that had gone north. And yet I knew that my anger might cloud my good judgment. I had to make certainty doubly certain. "Stay here until I call you," I shouted across to Zaras. I left him and I followed the string of distinctive footprints. I went only 120 paces before her footprints disappeared completely, but I was not too concerned. I could tell that she had been lifted off her feet by one of the mounted Arabs, probably Al-Hawsawi himself. Now she was probably perched up behind his saddle again. Not only were these signs evident, but they were endorsed by the aura which emanated from the head of Hathor that I held in my right hand. I looked back and signalled Zaras to join me. He brought up my camel. I mounted and led our cohort forward, following the tracks of the Arabs who had turned off to the north, taking Tahuti with them. We rode up a slight undulation in the desert floor, and as we topped the next rise, I became aware of the fading power of the aura issuing from Tahuti's golden jewel. I reined down my mount abruptly. I looked around slowly at the vast, dun landscape. "What ails you, my lord?" Zaras brought his camel up alongside mine. "Tahuti did not come this way, after all," I said with certainty. "The jackal has tricked us." "That is not possible, Taita. I saw her footprints. There could be no doubt," he challenged me. "Sometimes the lie is clear to see, while the truth remains hidden," I told him as I turned my mount's head. "I don't understand, my lord." "That I know full well, Zaras. There is a great deal you will never understand, so I will not waste any more time trying to explain it to you." It was naughty of me, but I had to take my frustration out on somebody. Even though it was muted, I heard the grumbling and complaining amongst the men as they were forced to turn back and follow me. Zaras silenced them with a snarl. I rode back to the point where I had lost Tahuti's naked footprints, as she was lifted back into the saddle by Al-Hawsawi. I dismounted and gave the lead rein of my camel to one of the men to hold. I knew that there was something that I had overlooked, but it continued to elude me. I walked back to where the two troops of Bedouin had split up, and I examined the ground minutely. Were there any tracks going in a contrary direction? I pondered. The answer was that there were not. From the point at which they had separated, the two troops had kept straight on. Nobody had turned back. However, I knew that I was looking at the answer to the anomaly, but I could not recognize it. "She must have gone back," I whispered to myself. "She did not continue forward with the second troop. So she must have gone backwards." I checked myself. Why had I employed the word backwards? It was incorrect in that context, and my usage of words is usually flawless. "A person does not go backwards," I spoke aloud now. I knew how close I was to the solution. "A person either turns back or walks backwards." I broke off again. That was it. I had it. I ran back to where the trail of Tahuti's naked footprints ended. Because I now knew what to look for, I picked it out immediately. There was another set of masculine footprints which seemed to be going in the same northerly direction as all the others in the troop. However, now I picked out subtle differences. These odd footprints began where Tahuti's footprints came to an end. They trod on top of all the other prints. Whoever had made those footprints was carrying heavy weight. Most significantly, at every pace, the heel of his sandals had thrown a little feather of sand backwards, whereas I might have expected the toe to throw the sand forwards. The jackal made those footprints. I worked it out, almost seeing it happen as I spoke. Firstly, he set Tahuti down at the point where the gang split. He forced her to walk forward in front of his horse, following his northerly troop. After they had covered 200 paces, he dismounted. He sent his horse on with the northerly troop,
then picked Tahuti up bodily and carried her back to where the first group was waiting for him. But now he was walking backwards, carrying her over his shoulder. The first group had another horse waiting for him and Tahuti. On this horse he carried Tahuti away with the southerly troop, leaving us to chase off after the northerly group. All this was devilishly complicated and cunning. I smiled grimly, but not quite cunning enough. I spoke aloud with satisfaction. Zaras and his men were watching me with expressions of confusion and total mystification, which only deepened further as I turned my back on Tahuti's palpable footprints and led them back to where the two groups of Bedouin had parted company. As I set off in pursuit of the smaller, southerly group, I expected Zaras, or at least one of his men, to protest, and I was somewhat disappointed when none of them could summon up enough courage to challenge my decision. With every league, I led them southwards. The warmth, radiating from the golden head of the goddess I held in my hand, grew stronger. I knew how Tahuti was suffering by this time. She had been wearing only a light cotton tunic when the jackal captured her. This would have given her very little protection from the wooden saddle under her or the sun above her. I had seen the blood from her torn feet where she had been forced to walk. The feet of an Egyptian princess are more delicate than those of a peasant girl. One consolation for me was my conviction that the jackal would never have allowed himself or any of his men to violate her barely mature body. She was much too valuable in her virgin state. He must be astute enough to realize that he could buy 10,000 pretty slave girls for her ransom price. Nevertheless, I was sorely tempted to increase the pace and push the camels to their utmost to save her from even one more hour of her torment. My usual good sense restrained me. I knew that the jackal might have a few more desperate tricks to play, and that I had to have something in reserve to counter those. I kept the camels down to that relaxed trot, but there were no more stops to drink or rest. We rode on through the morning. Then, an hour after the sun had made its noon, I led the climb up another ridge of compacted sandstone, and when I reached the summit I was looking down into a wide basin of ground many leagues across. This was a valley of giant natural sculptures that had been fashioned by the winds of eternity. Ramparts and pinnacles of petrified red rock thrust their heads so high that they seemed to brush the belly of the pale blue sky. But their bases had been eaten away by the wind until they were slender pillars upon which their massive heads were balanced. My eyes were the oldest in the cohort, but, as usual, they proved to be the sharpest. I was the first to pick out the fugitives. Even when I pointed them out to Zaras and the men, they could not make out the cluster of humanity in the shadows at the base of one of the gigantic stone monoliths. To be fair to them, the heated air rising from the sun-baked rocks trembled and quivered with mirage, disturbing their vision. Then a pinpoint of sunlight was reflected off a blade or the tip of a lance, and this immediately focused their attention. There were shouts of triumph and bloodthirsty battle cries from the cohort behind me, but I knew that the worst was yet to come. We were now facing desperate men, and Tahuti was in greater peril than she had ever been since the jackal had seized her. With an abrupt gesture, I silenced the men and led them back behind the ridge. I left a trustworthy sergeant and two of his men to keep the Bedouin under surveillance. Then, once we were off the skyline, I allowed the rest of my cohort to dismount, to rest, and ready their weapons for combat. From the pack on my camel's back, I took down my war bow in its leather carrying bag, and my arrow quiver. I carried these with me when I led Zaras aside. I found a seat on a slab of sandstone, and I beckoned Zaras to sit beside me. All their horses are down. They cannot run any further. The jackal has chosen his ground on which to make his last stand. I began, and then I went on to explain exactly what he had to do if we were to extricate Tahuti, unhurt, from the jackal's clutches. When I finished, I made him repeat my instructions, so that there could be no misunderstanding. While we were talking,
I rebraced my bow with a new bowstring. Then from the quiver I selected 3 arrows, which appeared at first glance to be perfect. These I rolled between my hands to detect the slightest distortion. When they passed my stringent scrutiny, I tucked them under my belt. I left the arrows which I had rejected in the quiver, which I strapped to my back. It was unlikely that I would get a chance to shoot more than a single arrow, and that would have to be at extreme range. If another opportunity presented itself, I would not have a moment to waste in making my arrow selection. "I am ready, Zaras." I stood up and slapped his shoulder. "Are you?" He jumped to his feet. "Yes, Taita. I am ready to die for the princess." It was a melodramatic declaration, but I was moved by his sincerity. Young love has a peculiar splendour all of its own. "I think both Princess Tahuti and I would prefer you to remain alive," I remarked dryly, and I led him back to join the waiting cohort. While Zaras was giving them their orders, I appropriated the crocodile skin cuirass and bronze helmet from one of the guardsmen and donned them to conceal my distinctive robes and long flowing hair. I did not wish to stand out from amongst my men. When our preparations were completed, we remounted, and crossing back over the ridge, we started down into the valley of sandstone monoliths, walking the camels sedately towards the place where the jackal and his men were waiting for us. I took this last opportunity to adjust the leather guard over my left forearm to protect myself from the lash of the bowstring. The wound that I had already inflicted on myself was still open and weeping. Zaras was leading the cohort. Our men were bunched up in close order, 20 paces behind him. I was no longer riding in the van beside Zaras. Inconspicuous in my borrowed armour, I hung back on the extreme left flank of the second rank. I concealed my war bow under the saddle cloth of my camel, where it could not be seen by the enemy until I raised it. Zaras rode well out in front of our formation, where he could focus the jackal's attention upon himself. He had reversed his sword, holding it high with the hilt uppermost. This was the universal sign of truce. I knew that the jackal would be expecting this invitation to parley, for we were locked in a stalemate. He could not escape, all his horses were down, and his men were played out. On the other hand, we could not charge in to finish it while he still had a knife to Tehuti's throat. I had to rely on Zaras to get me within certain bowshot of the jackal without triggering his murderous reaction. As we closed, I was able to study the ground more effectively. From my reading of their spoor, I knew that the number of Al-Hasawi's men had been whittled down by splitting and by the hostile desert to 15 survivors. I had 56 guardsmen, including Zaras. All of them were relatively fresh and in fighting condition. There could only be one outcome if it came down to a fight to the finish. They would all die, but then so would Princess Tehuti. Al-Hasawi had chosen with care his final position under the towering loom of the sandstone monolith. The rock secured both his flanks, but it gave him an additional advantage. The shelving sandstone roof that extended out over his position limited the range of even my great war bow. I could not stand off at a distance and loft my arrow high enough to kill the jackal without my arrow first striking the roof of rock above his head. I had to get into closer quarters and shoot on a much flatter trajectory. However, the red rock was also the jackal's prison wall. It cut off any line of retreat. He had to negotiate an exchange with us, the lives of his men and himself for that of my princess. Led by Zaras, we rode slowly towards where the jackal was waiting at bay. Now I was able to see that the horses of the Bedouin had all succumbed to the thirst and the harsh conditions. The Arabs had dragged the last few carcasses into a half-circle, facing outwards towards us. Behind this makeshift and pathetically inadequate stockade, the survivors now crouched. Just the tops of their heads were showing, together with the tips of the lances and curved scimitar blades, which they presented to us. As we closed with them, I could see that there were at least three of the Arabs holding bows with arrows nocked, ready to let them fly at us. But the Bedouin are not archers of any consequence. Their bows are feeble, with half the range of the mighty recurved weapon that was clamped under the saddle cloth beneath my knee, ready to my hand. Now, everything depended on how close these meagre fortifications Zaras was able to bring me, before Al-Hasawi called a halt to our approach. I was judging the shortening range with every pace my camel took under me. We reached the critical point from which I knew that I could lower my trajectory and reach any of the Arabs with my arrow without fear of hitting the stone roof that hung over their heads. I grunted with relief. Every pace forward that my camel took from here onwards placed me in a stronger position. The guardsman riding in the rank ahead of me was screening me as I reached down and took my grip on the war bow. Then, without glancing down, I selected an arrow from those on my belt with my free hand. I laid it across the top end of the hand grip of my bow and held it there with the forefinger of my left hand. My camel carried me forward, another five slow and stately paces, before a man came to his feet in the centre of the Bedouin line and faced us. He threw back the hood of his burnous to uncover his face, and he roared at us in Arabic, "Stop! Come no closer!" The echoes of his voice boomed off the roof of sandstone above him. I recognized him at once as the black-bearded brute I had last seen 3 days previously, throwing Tahuti onto his saddle as he leered at me under his upraised arm. This was confirmed for me immediately as he shouted again, "I am Al-Hasawi, war chief of the Bedouin. All men fear my might." He reached down, and from behind the carcass of his horse, where he had concealed her, he lifted Tahuti to her feet. Now he held her so that we could see and recognize her face. His left arm was locked around her throat from behind, choking her, so she dare not struggle or cry out. In his right hand he held his naked sword. Tahuti's body screened his as he glared at us over her shoulder. Al-Hasawi had stripped Tahuti of every stitch of her clothing. I knew he had done this to humiliate her and to demonstrate how completely he dominated her. Her limbs seemed slender and childlike when compared to the massive hairy arm which he had clamped around her throat. The skin of her naked form was opalescent as mother of pearl. Her eyes were so huge with fear that they seemed to fill her face. Zaras leapt down from the back of his camel, and still proffering his reversed sword, he started walking slowly towards where Al-Hasawi was holding Tahuti. He lifted the visor of his helmet, revealing his identity, just as Al-Hasawi had done. As she recognized Zaras, I saw the terror fade from Tahuti's eyes, to be replaced by the fierce light of courage and hope. Her lips moved as they formed his name, but the sound of it was throttled by the thick arm around her throat. I was proud of her then, as proud as I had ever been of her mother. But I closed my mind to all these distracting thoughts and memories. My eyes measured the range, and my mind calculated the loft and drift of my arrow in flight. I felt the light breeze on my left shoulder, but I saw that where Al-Hasawi stood, he was sheltered from it by the bulk of the great slab of sandstone. Only a master archer could be certain of that target. First the wind drift to the right, and then the patch of still air as the arrow fell the last few cubits to strike its target. Al-Hasawi was lashing himself into a fury, hurling abuse and warning Zaras to stand where he was and to come no closer. He held his short sword in his right hand and was pressing the point of the bronze blade up under Tahuti's jaw into the soft swell of her throat. "Stand your ground, or I will kill this bitch and cut out her putrid and diseased ovaries," he screamed at Zaras. "Nobody has to die," Zaras called back in a placatory and appeasing tone. "We can talk."
He kept moving towards the pair. I edged my camel forward. Zaras was winning me precious ground. Every pace my mount took made my shot that much less formidable. What was more important was that he was forcing Al-Hasawi to turn slightly to keep facing him. He was opening the target area for my arrow. I needed only to divert the attention of the jackal for the time it would take me to draw and loose, and for the arrow to fly to its mark. Without moving my head, I emitted the cry of a hunting falcon as it begins its stoop. My life sign is that of the wounded falcon. I have perfected the cry. Even the most experienced falconer is unable to tell my imitation from that of the actual bird. The rock walls amplified and echoed the sound, so that it carried clearly above Al-Hasawi's tirade of abuse. All Bedouin are avid falconers, and Al-Hasawi recognized that evocative call and was not able to resist it. He cut short his stream of foul abuse and glanced up to where he thought the cry had emanated. It was a momentary distraction, but all I needed. I brought my bow and my perfect arrow together, and they knocked and fitted like the bodies of divine lovers cast in paradise for each other. I drew, and as the bowstring touched my lips, I loosed. I watched the arrow climb, reach its zenith. It skimmed the rock roof above the jackal's head without touching, and then began to drop. To me it seemed to be moving with a stately grace, but I knew that only an eye as keen as mine could follow it. Then I saw the jackal's eyes flicker in their sockets. Impossible as I knew it to be, he had seen, or, like a wild animal, he had sensed my arrow dropping towards him. His head jerked up slightly and his body began to turn. Then my arrow struck him high in the chest and a hand's breadth to one side. He had moved just enough to disturb my aim, and I knew that my arrowhead had missed his heart. Nevertheless, the weight and speed of the strike hurled him backwards. Instinctively, he threw his arms open in an attempt to regain his balance, but his legs collapsed under him, and he slammed into the sandstone floor. Tehoti was sent spinning from his grip. I saw her twist her body in the air, and she landed with the agility of a cat. She rebounded to her feet and poised, naked and lovely, momentarily bewildered by the sudden turmoil that boiled around her. Zaras had been ready for the cry of the falcon, that we had agreed upon earlier. As I uttered it, so he launched himself towards where Tehuti stood. He was as swift as a hunting cheetah. He had to run past the jackal's prostrate body to reach Tehuti. He saw my arrow protruding from Al-Sawi's upper body, and he thought that I had killed him. He paid him no further attention. He reached Tehuti before any of the other Bedouin realized what was happening. He grabbed her and thrust her bodily behind him, shielding her with his own bulk. He tossed up the sword he was holding reversed in his other hand, and as it dropped, he caught it by the hilt and went into an on-guard position, waiting to meet the rush of Arabs that were coming at him. "Charge!" I urged our men forward to protect the couple. "Have at them, lads!" I goaded my camel into a lumbering gallop, and at the same time knocked another arrow. I saw one of the Arab archers check his forward run and lift his bow, aiming at Zaras. I shot my arrow an instant before the Arab could lose his. I struck him in the throat, just in time to spoil his shot. His own arrow flew wide, and the Arab fell to his knees clutching at my shaft, which protruded from his throat, bright blood spouting from his gaping mouth. Undaunted, one of his comrades rushed at Zaras, and with his scimitar raised high, launched a blow at his head. Zaras swatted the Arab's blade aside, and then used his momentum to sever the man's sword arm cleanly at the elbow. The Arab screamed and stumbled backwards, clutching the stump of his arm. He tripped over the kneeling man with my arrow in his throat. They went down together in a heap, obstructing the charge of their comrades. I shot my third arrow and brought down another Bedouin bandit. Zaras turned his head and flashed an approving grin at me. Incredulously, I realized that the young idiot was actually enjoying himself. "Come back here," I shouted at him. "Bring Tahuti to safety."
He lifted her off her feet as though she was a small child, and he slung her over his left shoulder.
"Put me down,"
she yelled at him, and kicked her legs wildly to be free. He ignored her protests and started back to meet us as we raced forward to cover his retreat.
Al-Hasawi still lay where my arrow had brought him down. All of us had switched our attention from him to the charging Bedouin. I was as guilty as any of them. I knew that the jackal had managed to duck my heart shot, and that he was probably still alive. But I thought that at least I had crippled him, and that he was no longer a menace to any of us. His inert body was spread-eagled, and his sword was trapped under him. Zaras had been forced to run past him to reach Tehuti. Now he was retreating and backing up towards him again. All Zaras' attention was concentrated on the Arabs, who were menacing him. Suddenly, Al-Hasawi rolled over and sat up. Now he had his sword in his right hand, but he did not have the strength to come to his feet. "En garde, Zaras!" I yelled at him as I groped for another arrow, but the closed lid of my quiver thwarted me. "Behind you, Zaras! Beware the jackal!" Perhaps my voice was drowned out by the hubbub of battle. Or perhaps he did not understand my warning. He took another step backwards, which brought him into range of Al-Hasawi's blade. With an incoherent shout of despair, the jackal lunged at him. The thrust was from below and behind. The blow lacked power, but Al-Hasawi's point was sharp enough to pierce Zaras' leather skirt and go between his sturdy young legs. Al-Hasawi tried feebly to pull his blade free of Zaras' clinging flesh, but he did not have the strength to do so. He fell backwards and supported himself on his elbows. As he panted hoarsely for breath, the shaft of my arrow, which protruded from his chest, twitched in time to his breathing, and a trickle of blood ran from the corner of his mouth. Zaras' entire body buckled and then stiffened into rigidity. His sword fell from his right hand and lay at his feet. Tehuti wriggled out from the grip of his left arm and landed on her feet. "Go to Taita," I heard him gasp to her through the pain. "I am killed. Taita will defend you."
He doubled over and clutched at his lower belly, where he could feel the sword blade deep inside him. Tehuti ignored his instruction. She stood transfixed beside him. It seemed to me that at first she was unable to comprehend what had happened, until she looked down and saw the haft of the jackal's sword protruding from under Zaras' skirt, and the blood dribbling down from between his legs. Zaras fell forward onto his knees. He bowed his head until his forehead touched the ground. Standing over him, Tehuti's face twisted into a mask of anger, and she screamed at Al-Hasawi,
"You have killed Zaras! You have killed my man!"
She snatched up Zaras' sword from where he had dropped it. She turned on the jackal with strength that was out of all proportion to the delicacy of her body, and a fury out of keeping with her femininity. She drove the point of the sword into the jackal's throat. His breath hissed from his severed windpipe, and he grasped the naked blade with both hands, as though to prevent her stabbing him again. With frenzied strength, Tehuti ripped the blade from his throat. As it slid through Al-Hasawi's clutching fingers, the razor-sharp edge sliced them down to the bone. Tehuti stood over him and thrust again and again into his chest, between his ribs and into his vitals. My men swept past where Tehuti stood, driving the surviving Bedouin ahead of them, leaning out from the saddle to run them through with their long cavalry lances. I let them go. I reined in my camel beside Tehuti and swung down from the saddle. I threw my arms around her and held her until she quietened, and then I plucked the sword from her hands. "You have killed him 10 times over, I told her sharply. "Now Zaras needs our help." I knew that his name would calm her fury and focus her mind. I did not want to move Zaras, as doing so can often aggravate such an injury as he had received.
I had the men build a rude shelter over him, where he lay. While we were doing this, I ordered the sergeant of the guards to collect the cleanest and least blood-stained robes from the Arab corpses and bring them to me. I used these to protect Tehuti from the sun and from the fascinated scrutiny of the men. Then I ordered them to drag the dead Arab horses and the corpses of the jackal and his men a league downwind and dump them in the desert. In this heat, they would begin putrefying within the hour. The last I ever saw of the jackal, he was being towed, naked, behind a camel, with a slipknot around his ankles, and his head bumping over the stony ground. His arms extended over his head, towards me, were flapping as if in farewell. I had brought with me my medical pack and a small supply of herbs and drugs. These go with me always and everywhere, almost as though they are part of my own body. But I knew before even I began to examine Zara's wound that they were inadequate for the task that lay ahead of me. I had no trained assistant to help me. The rough guardsmen with me were all highly proficient at taking human life, but abysmally ignorant when it came to saving and succouring it. The only one that I had whom I could trust was Tehuti. She had helped me care for injured horses and other domestic animals. But I still looked upon her as a child. I did not want her to watch Zaras die, as he was bound to do. But I had no choice. "You will have to help me care for him, Princess," I told her, as I prepared a draught of the juice of the red shepherd flower that was powerful enough to stun an ox. "Yes," she responded quietly, but with such fixed determination that I was reminded forcibly of her mother. "Just tell me what you want me to do, and I will do it. First of all, make certain he drinks all of this." I handed her the copper cup, brimming with the narcotic. She placed his head in her lap. She held the vessel to his lips and pinched his nostrils closed so that he was forced to gulp it down. In the meantime, I laid out my surgical instruments. When the pupils of Zara's eyes dilated and he fell into a stupor induced by the drug, we removed his armor and his underbreeches. Then we laid him mother naked on his stomach on a bed of saddle blankets. Of course, I had seen Zaras naked before, but as always, I was impressed by his magnificent physique. I felt a deep pang of regret that so soon we would have to consign this masterpiece of nature to the earth. I separated his legs so that I could reach the entry point of the jackal's blade. Of course, the blade was still sealing the wound. I know others who claim to be surgeons who would have ripped it out without a care or a thought, sealing their patient's fate in the instant. While I studied the angle and depth of the blade's entry, I saw that the sword thrust had missed his masculine parts entirely. This was a state of affairs about which I had mixed feelings. I silently rejoiced for the sake of Zaras and Tehuti. However, on my own account, I was not so sanguine. Perhaps it would have been preferable if these basic organs of Zaras had been rendered harmless by the cutting edge of the sword. If that had happened, then many of those problems which I foresaw looming ahead of me might have been eliminated at a single stroke. I thrust such unworthy thoughts aside and gave my full attention to the removal of the blade. It had passed through his left buttock. If it had then struck the cradle of heavy pelvic bone, it might have gone no further. This had not happened. I could tell that it had found a pathway along which to enter the bony basin in which Zara's entrails were contained. I have taken the opportunity to dissect and study hundreds of human cadavers. I know how the food we eat is passed down through these fleshy tubes until it is voided from the fundamental orifice set between our buttocks. I was now seriously alarmed. If the jackal's blade had punctured one of these tubes in Zara's gut, the waste would have leaked into his stomach cavity. This waste, that we refer to familiarly as dung, is composed of evil humours, which give it the characteristic unpleasant smell. These humours are also fatally poisonous, and if set free in the body will cause it to mortify. Death, is the inevitable consequence. The sword had to come out at once. I summoned six of our strongest men to restrain Zaras, for despite the powerful opiate that I had given him, the pain that he must suffer would render the drug ineffectual. Tahuti sat with his head in her lap. She stroked his hair and crooned to him like a mother to her infant. The holders took their places and pinned his limbs. I knelt between his legs and took a double-handed grip on the hilt of the sword. "Hold him," I gave the order. And then I leaned back and applied all my weight and strength, keeping the blade aligned with its entry channel so as to avoid further damage to his flesh and innards. Zaras' entire body stiffened. Every muscle tensed hard as marble, and he bellowed like a wounded bull with agony. The six strong men were hard put to restrain him. For a long moment nothing gave. The bronze blade was trapped in a vice-like grip, jammed against the pelvic bone and held by the suction of clinging tissue. Then the suction broke, and the blade slid from the wound. I toppled over backwards. Zaras gave one last shuddering moan, and his body slumped back into unconsciousness. I had a pad of lamb's wool already, and I placed this over the wound and ordered Tahuti, "Hold this in place, but put all your weight on it to try and stop the blood." Then I looked to the men who were holding him down. "Release him," I ordered them. I switched my attention to the sword in my hand, and with my eye measured how deeply in it had penetrated. 1.5 hand's length, 0.5 cubit, I estimated, with dread overshadowing hope. That's deep. Too deep. Briefly I lifted the pad that Tahuti was pressing over the wound. I leaned forward to examine the wound. It was a slit as wide as 2 of my fingers together. As soon as I released the pressure on it, a thin trickle of blood leaked out. It looked clean and healthy. I brought my face close to it and sniffed at the blood. There was no odor of feces. I felt a flicker of renewed hope. Was it possible that the razor-sharp bronze had not sliced open his guts? Tahuti was watching me intensely. "What are you doing, Taita?" "I am trying to estimate our chances." I bound the pad of lamb's wool in place to cover the entry wound, and I dribbled distillate of wine over it to subdue the evil humours. Then I moved around behind Zaras and placed one of my hands on each of his buttocks. I steeled myself and then drew them apart. I let out a soft sigh of relief. His fundament was clean and tight. There was one more test I needed to make. I placed my hand on the small of his back and pressed down hard. There was a splatter of released gas from his bowels, followed by a spurt of watery excrement and bright blood from his anus. The stink made both Tahuti and me wince. Now I knew with fatal certainty that the sword had indeed pierced his entrails. I felt devastated with sorrow and despair. Zaras was a dead man. No surgeon in this world, however skilled, could save him, not even I. He belonged to Seth now. I did not look up at Tahuti, although I could feel that she was staring at me. I was helpless, and I hated that sensation. "Taita?" she whispered my name. Still I could not raise my eyes to her and admit my inadequacy. "Please, Taita?" Her voice rose slightly. "You can save his life, can't you? You can save Zaras for me?" I had to answer her. I could not allow her to suffer any longer. I lifted my head and looked at her. I had never seen such suffering and sorrow as hers, and I have seen freshly created widows by the scores. I formed the negative in my mind and on my tongue, and I even shook my head, but I could not utter the word no. I could not abandon these two young people. "Yes, I can save him for you, Tahuti." I knew it was a heartless thing to say. Finality is surely better than false hope. But I could not bear her anguish and despair. So silently I begged the good gods to pardon my lie, and I set out to do battle with Seth for Zara's soul.